why these two strangers were present in his flat. There was no offer of refreshment. Chamberlain cleared his throat. "First of all, I would like to thank you, Chancellor, for inviting me to your home, and for agreeing to hold one final conversation before I return to London." Schmidt translated faithfully. Hitler was sitting slightly propped forward by a cushion. He listened, nodded politely.
"Yeah.
I thought we might briefly discuss some areas of mutual interest between our two countries on which we might be able to cooperate in the future." Moore nodding.
"Yeah."
The Prime Minister reached into his jacket pocket and took out a small notepad. From his inside pocket he produced his fountain pen. Hitler watched him warily. Chamberlain opened the first page. "Perhaps we might begin with this terrible civil war in Spain." Almost all the talking was done by Chamberlain. Spain, Eastern Europe, trade, disarmament. He ticked off the list of topics he wished to raise, and to each Hitler responded briefly, without being drawn into detail.
"That is a matter of vital interest to Germany," was the most he would say, or, "Our experts have made a study of the subject."
He fidgeted in his chair, folded and refolded his arms, looked over at his adjutant. Leggett thought he was like a householder who had reluctantly agreed to let a salesman or a religious proselytizer over the threshold and now bitterly regretted it and was looking for an opportunity to get rid of him. Leggett himself kept glancing at the door, trying to work out how he might be able to escape long enough to whisper a warning to Hartmann. Even Chamberlain seemed to detect that his audience was becoming distracted. He said,
"I realize how busy you are. I mustn't detain you further. What I wish to say in conclusion is this. As I left London yesterday morning, women and children and even babies were being fitted with masks to protect them against the horrors of poison gas. I hope, Herr Chancellor, that you and I can agree that modern warfare, the brunt of which will be directed, as never before, against ordinary civilians, is abhorrent to all civilized nations."
"Yeah, yeah."
"I believe it would be a pity if my visit passed off with nothing more than the settlement of the Czech question.
In that spirit, I have drafted a short statement putting on record our mutual desire to establish a new era in Anglo-German relations that may bring stability to the whole of Europe. I would like us both to sign it."
Schmidt translated. When he came to the word statement, Leggett saw Hitler dart a look of suspicion at Chamberlain. The Prime Minister drew the two copies from his inside pocket. He handed one to Schmidt.
"Perhaps you would be kind enough to translate this for the Chancellor."
Schmidt glanced at it, and then began to read it out in German, carefully emphasizing every word.
"We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today, and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe."
Hitler nodded slowly.
"Yeah.
We regard the agreement signed last night, and the Anglo-German naval agreement, as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again." At that, Hitler cocked his head slightly to one side. Clearly he had recognized his own words. A slight frown appeared. Schmidt waited to be told to go on, but Hitler said nothing. In the end, the translator continued of his own accord.
"We are resolved that the question of consultation shall be the method adopted to deal with any other questions that may concern our two countries, and we are determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of difference and thus to contribute to assure the peace of Europe."
For several seconds after Schmidt had finished, Hitler didn't move. Leggett could see his gaze travelling round the room. A process of calculation was evidently underway. Presumably it was hard for him to refuse to sign sentiments which he had himself expressed in public, yet it was also obvious that he resented it, resented this fussy old English gentleman tricking his way into his home and presenting him with this démarche. He suspected a trap. The English were cunning, after all. On the other hand, if he signed it, at least the meeting would be over and Chamberlain would clear out. And in the end, it was only a scrap of paper, the expression of a pious hope, without any legal consequence. What did it matter? This, or at any rate something like it, was what Leggett afterwards surmised must have gone through the dictator's mind.
Ja, ich werde es unterschreiben.
The Führer says yes, he will sign it. Chamberlain smiled with relief. Hitler clicked his fingers at the adjutant, who hastened towards him, pulling out a pen. Danglars stood, as if he were about to act as a witness at a wedding. Leggett saw his chance, and walked over to the door. Hartmann had sat for 10 minutes in the deserted vestibule. The press summary lay on the chair beside him. To his left, he could hear the faint sounds of plates clattering, a woman's voice, a door opening and closing. That, he guessed, must be the service area, the kitchen, cloakroom, servants' quarters. The Führer's bedroom must therefore be to the right, the place he had emerged from. The door to the room where Chamberlain and Hitler were meeting was closed. He could hear nothing through the thick wood. Hanging next to it was a watercolour of the Vienna State Opera House, technically proficient, but stilted and soulless. He suspected it must be Hitler's own work. He rose and crossed the parquet floor to examine it. Yes, there were his initials in the bottom right-hand corner. Pretending to study the picture more closely, he glanced towards the Führer's bedroom in the shadows at the end of the passage. There was a room adjoining it, only 4 or 5 paces away. Curiosity overcame him. He looked towards the kitchen to check he was unobserved, then casually crossed to it and opened the door. It was a small bedroom looking out onto the trees in the back garden. The Venetian blind was half down. There was a strong, sickly, sweet scent of dried and fresh flowers and of dark cinnamon-like perfumes that had dehydrated in their bottles. On the dressing table were a vase of withered roses and a bowl of yellow and purple freesias. Draped across the bed was a simple white cotton nightdress. He walked to the end of the bed and opened the door to a bathroom. He could see through the open door opposite to Hitler's bedroom, a jacket hanging on the back of a chair. As he retreated, he took a closer look at the dressing table, a framed black-and-white photograph of a dog, a pile of notepaper with Angela Raubal on the top left corner, a copy of the fashion magazine Die Dame. He checked the date, September 1931. Lena had been right. Once he saw it, one could not doubt it. The proximity of the room to Hitler's, the unnatural, stifling closeness, the shared bathroom, the way it had been left as a shrine, like an Egyptian burial chamber. Behind him he heard a noise. He stepped back quickly and closed the door. Leggett was emerging from the drawing room. After glancing over his shoulder, he said in a quick, quiet voice, "I'm afraid I have bad news. The Gestapo have the document." It took Hartmann a moment to adjust his mind. He looked past Leggett to the open doorway, but couldn't see anyone. He whispered, "When?" "Less than an hour ago. They searched my room while I was showering." "You're sure it's definitely gone?" "No question of it. Paul, I'm so very sorry." Hartmann held up his hand to silence him. He needed to think. "If it's less than an hour, they must be looking for me. He stopped himself. The adjutant had appeared behind Leggett. He emerged from the drawing room, followed by Chamberlain and Hitler. After them came Schmidt and Danglars. The Prime Minister was holding 2 small pieces of paper. He gave one to Hitler. "This is for you, Herr Chancellor." Hitler handed it immediately to the adjutant. Now that his visitors were leaving, he seemed more relaxed.
"Dr. Schmidt begleitet Sie zu Ihren Hotel. Ich wünsche Ihnen einen angenehmen Flug."
Schmidt said, "I will escort you back to your hotel, Prime Minister. The Führer wishes you a pleasant flight." "Thank you." Chamberlain shook hands with Hitler. He looked as if he would like to make a further short speech, but decided against it. The adjutant opened the front door, and the Prime Minister went out onto the landing with Schmidt. Danglars said, with an edge of sarcasm, "Coming, Hugh?" Leggett was sure he would never see Hartmann again, but there was nothing he could say. He nodded to him and went out after the others. After the door had closed, Hitler stood staring at it for several seconds. He was rubbing the palm of his right hand with his left thumb, an unconscious action, round and round, as if he had sprained it. Finally, he noticed the press summary lying on the chair. He turned to Hartmann.
"Is that what the foreign press are saying?"
Hartmann said, "Yes, my Führer."
"Bring it in here."
Hartmann had been hoping to slip away. Instead, he found himself following Hitler into the drawing room. The adjutant was straightening the furniture, smoothing the cushions. Hartmann handed over the press summary. Hitler fished in his breast pocket for his spectacles. From the street below came the sound of cheering. Glasses in one hand, he glanced at the window, then went over to it. He pulled back the net curtain and stared down at the crowd. He shook his head.
"How can one make war with such a people?"
Hartmann crossed to a different window. The crowd had grown much larger in the last half hour, once word had got out that Chamberlain was in the building. Several hundred people were lining the opposite pavement. The men were waving their hats, the women stretching out their arms. The angle made it impossible to see the Prime Minister's car, but one could tell its progress by the way people's heads turned to follow it as he drove away. Hitler dropped the curtain.
"The German population has allowed itself to be duped. And by Chamberlain, of all people."
He shook out his spectacles and put them on one-handed. He began scanning the press summary. Hartmann's eye was caught by fresh activity in the street. A big Mercedes limousine roared into view and pulled up sharply opposite. Hartmann could make out Ribbentrop, and beside him Sauer. Plainly in a hurry, they jumped out and began crossing the road, looking right and left, even before their escort, a second Mercedes, carrying a quartet of SS men, had come to a stop. As he waited for a truck to pass, Sauer stared up at the apartment. Instinctively, Hartmann drew back to avoid being seen. Hitler was still flicking through the summary. In a mocking voice, he read out the headline in the New York Times,
"Chamberlain, hero of Munich crowds."
And then another sentence.
"The cheers for Hitler were mechanical and polite, but for Chamberlain they were ecstatic."
In the vestibule, the entry bell rang. The adjutant left the room. Hitler threw the document onto the sofa and went over to his desk. For a second time, Hartmann was left alone with him. He heard voices in the lobby. He slipped his hand inside his jacket. His fingertips touched metal, but then immediately he withdrew it. It was absurd. He was about to be arrested, yet still he could not act. And if he couldn't do it, who would? In that moment, in a flash of clarity, he saw that nobody, not him, not the army, not a lone assassin, that no German would disrupt their common destiny until it was fulfilled. The door opened and Ribbentrop came in. Sauer was behind him. They stopped and saluted. Sauer gave Hartmann a look of violent hatred. Hartmann felt a roaring in his ears. He readied himself. Ribbentrop, however, seemed nervous.
"My Führer, I am told you have just seen Chamberlain. He asked for a private meeting last night. I couldn't see the harm in it."
"May I ask what he wanted?"
"For me to sign a piece of paper."
Hitler picked it up from the desk and gave it to the Foreign Minister.
"He seemed such a harmless old gentleman. I thought it would be rude to refuse."
Ribbentrop's face seemed to tauten as he read it. Of course the Führer could not have made an error. It would be unthinkable even to suggest it. But Hartmann could sense a change of atmosphere in the room. Eventually Hitler said irritably,
"Oh, don't take it all so seriously. That piece of paper is of no further significance whatsoever. The problem is here, with the German people."
He turned his back on them and went to examine the papers on his desk. Hartmann saw his chance. With a slight bow, first to the Foreign Minister and then to Sauer, he withdrew towards the door. Neither attempted to stop him. A minute later, he was out on the street. Chapter 4. The Lockheed Electra was bucketing through the low cloud that covered the English Channel. Beyond the windows, there was nothing to be seen except an infinity of grey. Leggett sat in the same rear seat he had occupied on the flight to Munich, his chin in his hand, staring out at nothing. The Prime Minister was at the front with Wilson. Strang and Malkin were in the middle. Only Ashton Gwatkin was missing. He was still in Prague, selling the agreement to Czechs. The atmosphere on board was exhausted, melancholy. Malkin and Dunglass were asleep. There was a hamper of food in the locker behind Leggett's seat, provided by the Regina Palace Hotel, but when Chamberlain had been told it was a present from the Germans, he had given orders it was not to be touched. It didn't matter. Nobody was hungry. Leggett could tell by the pressure in his ears that they were starting to descend. He took out his watch. It was just after 5. Wilson leaned out of his seat. "Hugh," he gestured to him to come forward. "Gentlemen, could we talk?" Leggett walked unsteadily to the front of the plane. Strang and Malkin shifted into the seats behind the Prime Minister. He and Dunglass had to stand with their backs to the cockpit. The plane lurched, and they knocked into one another. Wilson said, "I've been speaking to Commander Robinson. We should be on the ground in about 30 minutes. Apparently there's quite a crowd waiting for us, as you might imagine. The King has sent the Lord Chamberlain to conduct the PM directly to Buckingham Palace, so that their Majesties can convey their thanks in person. There will be a meeting of the Cabinet as soon as we get back to Downing Street." The Prime Minister said, "Obviously I shall have to make a statement to the cameras." Strang cleared his throat. "May I say, Prime Minister, that I would urge you to treat any undertaking given by Hitler with the utmost caution. The actual agreement over the Sudetenland is one thing. Most people will understand the reasons for that. But this other document..." His voice trailed off. He was seated directly behind Chamberlain. His long face was anguished. The Prime Minister had to turn his head slightly to reply to him, and Leggett registered again how stubborn he was in profile. "I understand the Foreign Office point of view, William. I know Cadogan, for example, believes we should treat appeasement simply as a regrettable necessity. Make it clear we have no practical alternative as things stand. Use it purely as an opportunity to buy time and announce a massive program of rearmament." "Well, we are rearming massively. Next year alone we shall devote more than half of all government expenditure to arms." And now he spoke to them all, perhaps particularly to Leggett, although he could never afterwards be sure. "I am not a pacifist. One thing I have learned in my dealings with Hitler is that one simply can't play poker with a gangster if one has no cards in one's hand. But if I speak in such terms when we land, that will simply give him the excuse to continue his belligerence. Whereas, if he keeps his word, and I happen to believe he will, we will avoid war." Strang persisted. "But what if he breaks his word?" "If he breaks it, well, then the world will see him for what he is. No one then can be in any doubt. It will unite the country and rally the dominions in a way they simply are not at the present. Who knows?" He permitted himself a slight smile. "Perhaps it will even bring the Americans in on our side." He patted his pocket. "Therefore, I intend to give this joint declaration the maximum publicity as soon as we land in London." It was 5:38 p.m. when the Prime Minister's plane finally broke through the clouds and appeared above Heston Aerodrome. As the ground flickered into view, Leggett could see the traffic along the Great West Road. Cars were halted for more than a mile in either direction. It had been raining heavily, headlights reflected off the wet tarmac. A vast swarm of people, thousands upon thousands of them, was clustered at the airport gates. The Lockheed roared low over the terminal building, dropping fast. He gripped the armrests. The wheels bounced on the grass runway a couple of times, then settled, and they lurched over the airfield at 100 miles an hour, sending up sprays of water on either side, then braking sharply before turning onto the concrete apron. The scene beyond the window in the autumn gloom was chaotic. Cameramen and newspaper reporters, airport workers, policemen, scores of Eton schoolboys, bizarre in their formal dress, Cabinet ministers, MPs, diplomats, members of the public, and the House of Lords, the Lord Mayor of London in his ceremonial chain. Even at a distance, Leggett could make out the immensely tall figure of Lord Halifax in his bowler hat, standing like Don Quixote beside the diminutive Sancho Panza of Sir Alexander Cadogan. Sires was with them. Their umbrellas were furled. It must have stopped raining. There was only one car, a big old-fashioned Rolls-Royce flying the Royal Standard. A man in overalls guided them onto their stand and signalled that the pilot should cut the engines. The propellers stuttered to a stop. The cockpit door opened. As before, when they landed in Munich, Commander Robinson stopped to exchange a few words with the Prime Minister, then came down the sloping aisle and opened the rear door. This time the gust of air that blew into the cabin was English, cold and wet. Leggett stayed in his seat as the Prime Minister went past. His jaw was clenched with tension. How odd that a man so fundamentally shy should thrust himself into public life and fight his way to the top. The breeze caught the door, flapping it shut, and Chamberlain had to fend it off with his elbow. He bent out his head and descended into a terrific din of clapping and cheering and shouting that seemed almost hysterical. Wilson stood in the aisle and held back the others until the Prime Minister had cleared the bottom of the steps. The moment of glory must be the chief's alone. Only after Chamberlain had started moving along the receiving line, shaking hands, did Wilson venture out after him, followed by Strang, Malkin, and Dunglass. Leggett was the last to leave. The steps were slippery. The pilot caught his arm to steady him. In the damp blue twilight, the lights of the newsreel cameras were a brilliant white, like frozen lighting. Chamberlain finished greeting the dignitaries and turned to stand in front of a bank of a dozen microphones, crested with the names of their respective organizations, BBC, Movietone, CBS, Pathé. Leggett could not see his face, only his narrow back and sloping shoulders silhouetted against the glare. He waited for the cheering to subside. His voice carried thin and clear in the wind. "There are only two things I want to say. First of all, I received a tremendous number of letters during all these anxious days, and so has my wife, letters of support and approval and gratitude, and I cannot tell you what an encouragement that has been to me. I want to thank the British people for what they have done." The crowd cheered again. Someone shouted, "What you have done!" Another called out, "Good old Chamberlain!" "Next, I want to say that the settlement of the Czechoslovak problem, which has been achieved, is, in my view, only a prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler, and here is a paper which bears his name upon it, as well as mine." He held it aloft, flapping in the breeze. "Some of you have perhaps already heard what it contains, but I would like to read it to you." He was too vain to put on his spectacles. He had to hold it at arm's length to make it out. And that was Leggett's lasting image of the famous moment, carried, burned into the retina of his memory until the day of his death, many years later, the jagged black figure at the centre of a great, bright light, his arms stretched out like a man who had thrown himself onto an electrified fence. The second Lockheed came in to land just as the Prime Minister was being driven away in the King's Rolls-Royce. As Chamberlain reached the airport gates, the distant applause of the well-wishers merged with the roar of aircraft engines. Sires said, "My goodness, would you listen to that? The roads are blocked all the way into central London." "You'd think we'd just won a war rather than avoided one. There were thousands gathering in the Mall when we left. Apparently the King and Queen intend to take him out onto the balcony. Here, let me carry that." He lifted one of the red boxes out of the aircraft hold. "So, how was it?" "Pretty ghastly, to be honest." They walked together across the apron towards the British Airways terminal. When they had gone about halfway, the newsreel lights were abruptly extinguished. In the sudden murk, the crowd gave a good-humoured collective groan. They began to drift towards the exit. Sires said, "There's a bus to ferry us all back to Downing Street. God knows how long it will take." Inside the packed terminal, the Italian and French ambassadors were talking to the Lord Chancellor and the Minister of War. Sires went off to see about the bus. Leggett stayed behind to guard the red boxes. Exhausted, he sat down on a bench beneath a poster advertising flights to Stockholm. There was a telephone box by the customs desk. He wondered if he should call Pamela to let her know he had landed, but the thought of her voice and her inevitable questions depressed him. Through the large plate-glass window, he could see the straggle of passengers from the second Lockheed coming into the terminal. Sir Joseph Horner was between the two detectives. Joan was walking with Miss Anderson. She was carrying a suitcase in one hand and a portable typewriter in the other. She headed in his direction the moment she saw him. "Mr. Leggett!" "Really, Joan, do call me Hugh, for goodness sake." "Hugh, then." She sat down next to him and lit a cigarette. "Well, that was thrilling."
"Was it?"
"Yes, I'd say it was." She turned to face him and looked him up and down. Her gaze was frank. "I wanted to catch you before we left Munich, but you'd already taken off. I have a tiny confession to make."
"And what is that?"
She was very pretty, but he wasn't in the mood for a flirtation. She leaned in conspiratorially. "Between you and me, Hugh, I'm not altogether what I seem."
"No?"
"No. In fact, I'm something of a guardian angel." Now she was starting to get on his nerves. He looked around the terminal. The ambassadors were still talking to the ministers. Sires was in the telephone box, presumably trying to track down their bus. He said wearily, "What on earth are you talking about?" She hauled her suitcase up onto her lap. "Colonel Mingus is my uncle. Well, the father of a cousin, to be more precise about it, and he likes to give me the odd errand to run. In fact, the reason I was sent to Munich, apart from my typing skills, which are exemplary, was to watch over you." She snapped the catches, opened the lid, and from beneath her neatly folded underwear, extracted the memorandum. It was still in its original envelope. "I took it from your room last night, for safekeeping, after you went off with your friend. And really, Hugh, I like your name, by the way, it suits you. Really, Hugh, thank God I did." The fact of his continuing freedom was miraculous to Hartmann. That afternoon, as he left the Führerbau to be driven to the airport, and later, as he sat on board the Junkers passenger plane that had been chartered by the Foreign Ministry to fly them home, and especially that evening when he landed at Tempelhof, at each stage of his journey back to Berlin, he expected to be arrested. But there was to be no hand on his arm, no sudden confrontation by men in plain clothes, no, "Herr Hartmann, will you come with us?" Instead, he walked unmolested through the terminal building to the taxi rank. The city was full of Friday night revelers, enjoying the unexpected peace. He no longer felt the same contempt for them he had in Munich. Each raised glass, each smile, each arm around a lover, he now saw as a gesture against the regime. The bell inside her apartment rang unanswered for a long time. He was on the point of giving up, but then he heard the sound of the lock turning, and the door opened. And there she was. Later that night, she said, "They will hang you one day. You know that, don't you?" They were lying at opposite ends of the bath, facing one another. She had lit a candle. Through the open door came the sound of an illegal foreign radio station playing jazz.
"What makes you say that?"
"Because they told me so, just before they let me go. Stay away from him, Frau Winter. That is our advice to you. We know his type. He may think he's got away with it today, but we will catch him out eventually. They were perfectly polite about it."
"What did you say?"
"I thanked them for the warning."
He laughed and stretched out his absurdly long legs. Water slopped onto the floor. He could feel her skin smooth against his. She was right. They were right. They would hang him one day. On 20th August 1944, to be exact, in Plötzensee prison, at the end of a length of piano wire. He could sense his destiny, even if he could not be exact about it. But there was life to be lived before then, and a battle to fight, and a cause that was worth dying for. Leggett was finally sent home a little after 10 p.m., Cleverly had told him there was no need for him to wait until the end of the cabinet meeting. Sires would handle the boxes. He should take the weekend off.
He walked from number 10 through streets that were filled with people celebrating. Fireworks were being set off here and there across the city. The flashes of rockets lit the sky. The upstairs windows were in darkness. The children must be asleep. He turned his key in the lock and set down his suitcase in the hall. He could see the light on in the sitting room. Pamela put aside her book as soon as he came in. "Darling!" She jumped up and threw her arms around him. For more than a minute they didn't speak. Finally she broke away and cupped his face in her hands. Her eyes searched his. She said, "I have missed you so much. How are you? How are the children? Better for having you home." She started to unbutton his coat. He caught her hands. "No, don't. I'm not staying." She took a step backwards. "You have to go back to work." It was not a criticism. It sounded more like a hope. "No, it's not work. I'll just go up and see the children." The house was so small they shared a room. John had a bed. Diana was still in a cot. He never ceased to wonder at the quality of the silence when the children were asleep. By the glow of the landing light they lay, unmoving in the semi-darkness, their mouths slightly open. He touched their hair. He wanted to kiss them, but didn't dare unless he woke them. From the top of the chest of drawers, the eyepieces of their gas masks watched him. Gently he closed the door. Pamela had her back to him when he went back down into the sitting room. She turned, dry-eyed. Emotional scenes were never her style. He was thankful for that. She said calmly, "How long will you be gone?" "I'll just stay at the club. I'll come back in the morning. We can talk then." "I can't change, you know. If you want me to." "Everything has to change, Pamela. You, me, everything. I've been thinking I might resign from the service."
"And do what?"
"You won't laugh. Try me. I thought on the flight back that I might join the RAF. But I just heard Chamberlain on the wireless telling the crowd in Downing Street it was peace in our time." He shouldn't have done that. He regretted it the moment he said it. According to Dunglass, Mrs. Chamberlain had talked him into it. She was the one person he could never refuse. "So you still think there'll be a war?"
"I'm sure of it."
"Then what has this all been about? All this hope, this celebration?"
"It's simply relief. And I don't blame people for it.
When I look at the children, I feel it myself. But all that's happened, really, is that a tripwire has been laid down for the future. And Hitler will cross it. Sooner or later."
He kissed her cheek. "I'll see you in the morning."
She didn't reply. He picked up his suitcase and went out into the night. Someone in Smith Square was letting off rockets. In the gardens he could hear cries of delight. The old buildings gleamed fitfully in the cascades of falling sparks, and then returned to darkness. Acknowledgements. This novel is the culmination of a fascination with the Munich Agreement that dates back more than 30 years, and I would like to thank Dennis Blakeway, the producer with whom I made a BBC television documentary, God Bless You, Mr. Chamberlain, to mark the 50th anniversary of the conference in 1988. We have maintained a mild mutual obsession with the subject ever since. In Germany, my friends at Heine Verlag, Patrick Neimeyer and Doris Schuck, helped arrange my research in Munich. I am especially grateful to Dr. Alexander Krause for his expert guided tour of what was once the Führerbau and is now the Faculty of Music and Theatre, of which he is Chancellor, and to the Bavarian Interior Ministry for allowing me to visit Hitler's old apartment in Prinz Regententplatz, now used as a police headquarters. In Britain, my thanks go to Stephen Parkinson, political secretary at 10 Downing Street, and to Professor Patrick Salmon, chief historian at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. I was fortunate yet again to benefit from the advice and support of four shrewd first readers, to my editor at Hutchinson in London, Jocastin Hamilton, and at Knopf in New York, Sonny Mehta, to my German translator, Wolfgang Müller, and to my wife, Jill Hornby. My deepest thanks, as always. I would also like to acknowledge my debt to the following works. John Charnley, Chamberlain and the Lost Peace. Jock Colville, The Fringes of Power, Downing Street Diaries, 1939 to 1955. David Dilks, editor, The Diaries of Sir Alexander Cadogan. David Dutton, Neville Chamberlain. Keith Feiling, The Life of Neville Chamberlain. Joachim Fest, Albert Speer, Conversations with Hitler's Architect. Joachim Fest, Plotting Hitler's Death, The German Resistance to Hitler, 1933 to 1945. Hans Bernd Gisevius, To the Bitter End. Paul Gore Booth, With Great Truth and Respect. Sheila Grant Duff, The Parting of the Ways. Ronald Heyman, Hitler and Gehli. Neville Henderson, Failure of a Mission. Peter Hoffmann, German Resistance to Hitler. Peter Hoffmann, The History of the German Resistance, 1933 to 1945. Peter Hoffmann, Hitler's Personal Security. Heinz Hoerne, Canaris. Lord Hume, The Way the Wind Blows. David Irving, The War Path. Otto John, Twice Through the Lines, The Memoirs of Field Marshal Keitel. Ian Kershaw, Making Friends with Hitler, Lord Londonderry and Britain's Road to War. Yvonne Kirkpatrick, The Inner Circle. Alexander Krause, Number 12, Archisasse. Clemens von Klemperer, editor, A Noble Combat, The Letters of Sheila Grant Duff and Adam von Trott zu Solz, 1932 to 1939. Valentine Lawford, Bound for Diplomacy. Giles MacDonagh, 1938, Hitler's Gamble. Giles MacDonagh, A Good German, Adam von Trott zu Solz. Andreas Mayer, translator, Ciano's Diary, 1937 to 1938. Harold Nicholson, Diaries and Letters, 1930 to 1939. John Julius Norwich, editor, The Duff Cooper Diaries. NS Dokumentationszentrum, München, Munich and National Socialism. Robert Rhodes James, editor, Chips, The Diaries of Sir Henry Channon. Richard Ollard, editor, The Diaries of A.L. Rouse. Richard Overy, with Andrew Wheatcroft, The Road to War. David Reynolds, Summits, Six Meetings That Shaped the 20th Century. Andrew Roberts, The Holy Fox, A Biography of Lord Halifax. Paul Schmidt, Hitler's Interpreter. Robert Self, Neville Chamberlain. Robert Self, editor, The Neville Chamberlain Diary Letters, Volume 4. William L. Shirer, Berlin Diary. Reinhard Spitze, How We Squandered the Reich. Lord Strang, Home and Abroad. Thespina Stratigakos, Hitler at Home. Christopher Sykes, Troubled Loyalty, A Biography of Adam von Trott. A.G.P. Taylor, The Origins of the Second World War. Telford Taylor, Munich, The Price of Peace. D.R. Thorpe, Alec Douglas Hume. Daniel Todman, Britain's War, Into Battle, 1937 to 1941. Gerhard L. Weinberg, The Foreign Policy of Hitler's Germany, 1937 to 1939. Ernst von Weizsäcker, Memoirs. Sir John Wheeler Bennett, The Nemesis of Power, The German Army and Politics, 1918 to 1945. Stefan Zweig, The World of Yesterday, Memoirs of a European.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Munich by Robert Harris, read by David Rintoul. This program was produced and directed by RNIB Talking Book Studios. Text copyright 2017 by Canal K. Production copyright 2017, Random House Audiobooks. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.